Welcome to the Michael Rivero What Really Happened radio program.
And aloha, America. Welcome to our show today. It's Saturday, our end of the week, looking back at the insanity wrap-up here as we point out particularly interesting members of the asylum on who occupy Sodom on the Potomac. And it just seems to be getting weirder and weirder and weirder and weirder. Interestingly enough, I started yesterday's show talking about how discouraging and frustrating it can get for those of us, which of course includes everybody listening to the show right now, who are deeply concerned about the United States, what it has been revealed to be. And I used to say what it is becoming. We're beginning to understand and comprehend and deal with the fact the United States government is actually behaving the way it's always been behaving. It's just that we, the American people, were being lied to such an extent we couldn't see it. And I got some email the other day that very much reacted strongly to my commentary that the U.S. government is behaving pretty much the way the Nazis used to, in that we have slave labor factories, the prison industrial system, that we are targeting an ethnic minority as a scapegoat for the nation's problems, in this case the Muslims, that we are torturing people to death, that we are making up lies in order to justify invading other countries. And I got a very irate email from somebody who said, well, we don't have all those death camps and the Holocaust and all that stuff. Nobody could ever do that again. And that's what made the Nazis bad. And how dare you say the United States is acting the same way? And my reply to that is that, and this is not to get into questions about how much of the Holocaust story is real and how much of it is embellishment to suit certain political agendas. But the reality is that the people within Germany itself were completely unaware of any of that stuff until after the war was over. And somebody came in and said, here's what your government has been doing behind your back. So the bottom line is, given how much we are now aware has been hidden from us up until this point, it is impossible for any American to say that we know it all. It is impossible for any American to say it doesn't, you know, this is bad, but we know for a fact it will not get any worse. We absolutely don't know that. We're just now finding out about more of these secret rendition camps or these torture centers run by the U.S. in foreign countries, specifically for the purpose of concealing their activities from the American people. And we still don't know what has been going on in there. So the reality is, yeah, our government is, there may be, and we don't know this, but there may be a difference in scale. But hardly one in morality. Hardly one in morality at all. So I stand by my conclusion, given what we have learned about the U.S. government, and given that we have come to understand that our government has been engaging in these kind of war crimes and torture, going back at least to the intervention in the Panamanian Revolution, then, by their acts ye shall know them. Forget the flag, forget the speechification, forget about all the propaganda you're fed in the state-sponsored school. Look at what the government is doing and judge them on that. All right, moving right along here, and speaking of judging the government on certain things, and before we get really cranked up and out of control here, our phone number is 800-259-9231. 800-259-9231, the phone lines are open. Matt is in the control room, his hand hovering over the phone, ready to swoop down and snatch it up the instant it rings here. Now, we're getting into one of these very interesting he said, she said situations, and it's kind of good news because the focus is starting to move away from the Justice Department lawyers who wrote the memos that said, yeah, torture's cool and we can do this and we can do that and all the rest of that bad stuff, because those lawyers in the Justice Department, yes, what they did was wrong. Yes, they are accessories. Yes, they should be on the docket with war crimes trials. But they were being scapegoated and used as a distraction to save the ringleaders and the major players. Now we have Condoleezza Rice, who's basically admitted on tape that she was in the pipeline for, you know, giving the orders to carry out torture. And she's using that lame excuse about when the president does it, it's legal, I was only following orders, blah, 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 blah. It is complete contravention of the Nuremberg Principle. Condi, when we get to the war crimes stage, Condi's going to be in the docket on the basis of that videotape, and that is just the bottom line. Now we're getting into the congressional leaders, because it is starting to come out where the CIA is saying that it did brief congressional leaders in both parties back in 2002, before we even went into Iraq to search for the non-existent weapons of mass destruction. They were already grabbing and torturing people, trying to force confessions from them that could be used to justify the wars. And Congress was briefed, both parties were, they're now basically the CIA is saying it briefed all these congressional leaders. And this is where you get into this idea of payback being nasty. Because the CIA was scapegoated for the so-called bad intelligence about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. And mind you, I am no friend of the Central Intelligence Agency. I used to bang heads with them when I was at CBS Television City, and I was not particularly comfortable with these people. But in this case, they got scapegoated for the fact that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And yet we know that the information the White House was relying on to sell that to the American people was not coming from CIA. It came from the Pentagon Office of Special Plans, which we now know was compromised by an Israeli intelligence operation. Larry Franklin is still in prison, going to be in prison for many, many years for his part of the pipeline. Rosen and Wiseman, of course, they're out walking around free and wild and still up to no good, probably, in terms of AIPAC and its continued subversion of the U.S. Congress and Oval Office. But the CIA took the blame for it, and we know Dick Cheney was over at CIA literally browbeating everybody, saying, you've got to validate this, you've got to confirm this, you've got to do whatever. And the CIA tried to walk that very difficult fine line between following its orders and doing the job that it's supposed to do, which is to provide accurate, unbiased, objective information to the policymakers. And when it became obvious there weren't any weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, the blame got dumped on the CIA. And this, I think, is where the CIA is going to come back and say, you know, you shouldn't really annoy us. Because the CIA is releasing all this information about all the congressional members who were told about the aggressive interrogation techniques. And the memo, some of the memos actually say, they call it torture. It's not like they didn't know what they were doing. And Nancy Pelosi was one of those who the CIA says they directly informed about these aggressive techniques, which now we know why Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat, worked so hard to protect President Bush, a Republican, from any investigations. Remember when the Democrats took over control of the Congress in 2006? And we said, okay, we've got 2 years, we've got a Democratic Congress, now we're going to get investigations. We're going to get honest investigations into the torture, into the lies that led to war. And Nancy Pelosi became Speaker of the House, and the first thing she said is, nope, no investigations, we must be looking forward. I am getting sick of that expression. Anytime I hear a politician saying we must look forward means they've got something behind them they don't want you to see. And the other expression I'm getting really sick of hearing is glimmer of hope. Yes, not quite so many people lost their jobs and homes and livelihoods this week. So there's a glimmer of hope. Next time Barack Obama says glimmer of hope, I'm going to hurl right all over this microphone. So getting back to this torture situation, Nancy Pelosi initially tried to claim that, no, nobody talked to her. She had no idea what was going on. Well, because of more and more documentary evidence coming out saying that, yes, in fact, she was one of the congressional leaders who were informed about what was going on. Now she's pulling a Condi. Pelosi is saying she was told it was legal to torture these people to death. Because when the president does it, it's no longer a crime. Which, by the way, for you constitutional scholars, you go and read the Constitution. There's nothing in there about godlike powers of absolute infallibility. I mean, that's the Pope. And the other term they use is sovereign immunity, that the kings and lords of the land are above the law. That is also not in the Constitution. The president is an executive. He's not a sovereign. He's not a lord. He's not the Pope. He is held to the letter of the law at some point. We're going to take a break here. 800-259-9231, 800-259-9231. We'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome to What Really Happened Radio. Visit us online at whatreallyhappened.com. And now, set your eyes on the future and let's consider what really happened.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to our show here. We're talking about the torture scandal. We're just kind of wrapping that up here because we're going to try and cover a bunch of other stuff here today. And I know you're all tired of hearing about the torture, and we're all dealing with this literally an identity crisis, because as we have grown up here in the United States of America, we were indoctrinated with a certain set of beliefs and assumptions about what America was, what it stood for, and by extension, because we considered ourselves to be Americans, what it is we stand for and what we support. And now we're finding out that we have been pledging allegiance to something pretty horrific out there, and that we have been worshiping an illusion. And I guess probably any time you hear the word worship, there's an illusion hooked on the other end of it. That the country we were told we live in has never existed. It is a fake, a facade. It's like the Matrix. It's just this carefully crafted illusion that the corporate media keeps in front of your eyes to keep you happy and keep you working productively and keep you paying your taxes to feed the war machine. And it's a little bit of a psychic shock for us to wake up and realize what's been going on. If you haven't seen the Matrix, Truman Show, the guy has lived his entire life inside a carefully crafted illusion that exists for no other reason than to make a huge amount of money off of him. And one day he starts to notice that it isn't real anymore. So getting back to this whole situation with the torture scandal, we're starting to see the blame shift regatta. And they're starting to talk about a new commission, a new whitewash is what they're talking about. They're going to form a government investigation that's going to slap around some of the underlings and say, well, there was some confusion about what was legal and what wasn't, and therefore nobody is really to blame, and we've spent enough of your tax money now on this investigation, so you should just shut up and go back to working in your factories and fields and continue to feed the war machine, because we have now done our due diligence and determined that nobody is really to blame, and it's a shame about all those people who were tortured to death, but we'll send their families all an album of Kate Smith singing God Bless America, and that will make everything all right again. Now, I have a question here. As we watch our Congress going back and forth and saying, no, I wasn't told, and yes, I was told, but I was told it was legal. And here is something that is really kind of amazing. We, the American people, understand the principle that was established in the Nuremberg trials. You cannot just say you were only following orders. George Bush himself stated that in his video broadcast just before the invasion of Iraq, warning him, don't you dare burn up those oil wells, and don't commit war crimes, because you'll be prosecuted and you won't be able to say, I was only following orders. So we would assume that if we, the American people, understand the Nuremberg Principle, and that if W understood the Nuremberg Principle, we would assume our congressional leaders would understand it. Most of them are supposed to be lawyers. They should know the Constitution. They should know the Nuremberg Principle. For them to be coming out now with these comments about, I was told it was legal and that makes it okay, betrays either willful lying to the American people, which, of course, is the first assumption, or they're just plain idiots and they're too stupid to be in government anymore. And in either case, they need to be removed. We can't have idiots running this country anymore. That's why we're in the mess that we're in right now. And we certainly can't have people running the government who refuse to obey the laws. As I was saying before the break, sovereign immunity does not exist in the United States of America. It's not in the Constitution. Infallibility, that's, you know, we're not ruled by a pope. We're not ruled by a king or an emperor or a tyrant. The last time we were ruled by a king, we shot up a lot of his guys in the redcoats and we kicked him out of here because we didn't want to be ruled by a king. And That's why in the Constitution, and this was actually debated very, very heavily, I believe it or not, the chief executive of the United States, they didn't really have a formal name for him for a while. It got bandied about during those first couple of administrations what they were going to call the chief executive of the United States. And finally, they simply settled on president because they didn't want to use the word king or emperor or Lord Chamberlain or any of that stuff. So they just said, okay, he's presiding over the government. He's the president. And that's all the job was supposed to be, just sort of throw cold water on a lot of darn foolishness in the Congress. So we don't have those kinds of things in this country. Anybody who thinks that we do is obviously exceeding their constitutional limits. They're acting unconstitutionally and illegally, and we should throw cold water on them. Now, this brings me to the next aspect. I've been wondering how people deal with what's going on. And the other day we were talking about how do Americans deal with this crisis of identity when we're waking up and realizing that being an American isn't what we thought it was. That being an American now means supporting torture, which apparently is okay with a lot of the Christians out there, according to the Pew Research Center. But what about all the government spooks out there? We know that going back to Vietnam times, the FBI and various other intelligence agencies and now the civil police force, they have undercover informants everywhere, worse than the Stasi, just spying on you and filling out reports and in a lot of cases sabotaging you, setting you up to get arrested, doing anything to make you look bad to the media. A lot of dirty trick stuff. And I imagine it must be a lot of fun to be able to go out and act like that and know that nothing's ever going to happen to you. You're never going to get arrested. Nobody's going to say, ooh, bad person for setting fire to that orphanage and putting the blame over on those peaceniks. But I'm wondering, as it becomes more and more obvious what the government is really like, how are people who work for that government, how are they reacting? Now, I know there are some people who listen to this radio show who are working for the United States government, some in minor clerical roles and everything, but some people are basically listening to this show in order to write a little report and say, that jerk Rivero, he's out there talking about the 16th Amendment again, or whatever it is I'm going to be talking about. I know that there are government agents who are continually monitoring whatreallyhappened.com. for what is being posted there. And I know that because every time we have a poll on the webpage, there's always that steady 3-4% who will pick the option, which indicates, you know, unswerving fealty to the powers that be. And common sense tells you the people who are checking those boxes, if they really believe those things, they're not people who would be enjoying reading What Really Happened. So they're there because of other reasons. So common sense. And like I said, we've known all about this going back to Vietnam. I had two friends who turned out to be FBI informants. One of them, believe it or not, is now a rabbi on the East Coast. The other one I had known in college, and he was part of the FBI team that set up that phony peace riot, peace protest turned into a riot at Disneyland. So they're all over the place, and they're out there. How do you live with yourselves, doing what you do and now knowing what the government you work for is, really, when you strip off all the coverings and all the bunting and all the fireworks and all the rah-rah and the apple pie and mom and all the rest of that, you're dealing with a Nazi-like regime. How do you live with yourself? We'll be right back.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio? Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to our show here. We've got a caller on the line. I'm going to go to you in just a minute. But I wanted to kind of respond to one of our advertisers talking about colloidal silver. And my lovely wife, Claire, whose birthday it is today, but I can't tell you how old she is. It's classified information. And She's really into health and wellness, and every morning she gives me 80 different little vitamin pills that I have to take. So I rattle when I walk. If you hear that clicking sound, that's the vitamins down there moving around. But this colloidal silver issue, I want you to understand a couple of things from history. Have you ever wondered why silver has been traditionally favored for eating utensils? Because steel's been known, iron's been known, clay, wood utensils, so forth and so on. Kings and queens could afford gold utensils, and sometimes they have, but it's always the focus on silver because it was discovered during great plagues in medieval history that people who could afford to have silver or were using silver somehow seemed less likely to succumb to these illnesses. This is why silver goblets are such a traditional wedding gift to brides and grooms, because when you pour wine in there or whatever and you're drinking from it, you get these minute particles of silver ingested into your system. So definitely something to have. You know, I have a silver dollar on my bill clip and I fondle that all the time. And who knows, maybe I'll be able to defeat this dastardly swine flu by fondling my Morgan silver dollar. All right, going to go to the phones. Ben in the United Kingdom. Aloha, Ben. Welcome to the show. What is on your mind? I guess it's late at night over there.
It's actually 6:30.
Ah, okay. Well, it's 6:30 in the morning right here. Talk about the other side of the planet. What can we do for you today?
Well, I just want to thank you for all your efforts, and I hope Alex Jones is recuperating and getting back his energy. And I just wanted to ask you about the position of the UK with regards to the EU. I'm guessing that they're kind of shifting all the power to the EU, and I'm a little concerned that the UK will be, I guess, null and void in maybe a year or two.
Well, it's entirely possible. You know, these things are very much in flux. I know that the formation of the European Union has not been as smooth as many had hoped it would be, because unfortunately merging these disparate economies and cultures has not proven very, very easy. And I know a lot of people are saying that they're seeing signs that the European Union itself might actually be running into some rough times and could itself conceivably dissolve within the next 5 years, and everybody going back to being their own countries. And I think right now, as we see so much of our current economic troubles directly related to globalization, that the pressure to sort of recompartmentalize the world's economies and nations is probably going to return.
Yeah, well, I figure that, I don't know, they might want to hurry things up and get the union together, but I guess it's a wait and see situation. But I do want to thank you for your efforts. I'm a very big fan of you and Alex, and I was just telling my girlfriend, who now knows what is going on in the world, that there are a lot more people than we think we know. There are a lot more people that have woken up to what is going on. So I just wanted to call up and say that and just ask you for that question.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. What part of Great Britain are you in?
In the West Midlands.
Ah, okay. I got to tell you, the single most frustrating time in my entire life was in London. I was there to work for an animation company called Electric Image. I was there as a consultant on behalf of the company I worked for in Hollywood. And I had, after working very hard for while I was there, I had 4 hours left before I had to get to the airport, and I only had 4 hours to go through the British Museum, and I'm literally running from room to room. I'm looking at the Elgin Marbles and the Rosetta Stone and all the rest of it, and it was so frustrating because I wanted to stay. I could have spent a week in there, and I had to get to the airport, and it was so. And I didn't get down to Stonehenge either. And I didn't.
You're more than welcome to come visit us at the in the West Midlands.
I would love it. My wife would love it too, because she's part Irish.
You would be an honorary guest.
Oh, well, thank you very much, and I appreciate it, and maybe someday I'll be able to take you up on that.
Thank you kindly, sir.
Thank you very much for the phone call. All right, that was Ben in the United Kingdom. And, this idea about the European Union, the EU was formed at a time when Europe was struggling to compete with the almighty dollar, and after the EU was created and the euro became a very, very strong, reliable currency, and more countries decided to trade in it as the dollar began its decline, and that's what began the talk about a North American Union. And everybody wanted to form these larger and larger economic cooperative spheres so that our currencies could make war on each other. Well, there's a problem when currencies are making war on each other. Real people tend to die in the process. And as we were mentioning on the show yesterday, when you hear the phrase clash of civilizations, what they're really talking about is a clash of banking systems. The Western-style compounded interest banking system, which impoverishes people and makes the bankers very wealthy, versus the Islamic banking system, which tends to be a little bit more even-handed, to the point where even the Vatican is saying, you know, guys, we got to look at this, because the Islamic banks are not getting into these disasters that we are seeing in the Western-style banking. And the Western-style banks, they don't want to give up all that wealth and power and privilege. And anybody who challenges that, like John F. Kennedy, when he issued his U.S. notes, somehow they just seem to wind up dead. We're going to go back to the phones. We've got Thomas in Sweden. Aloha, Thomas. Welcome back to the show. What's on your mind today or tonight? Thomas? Okay,
There we go. You hear me now?
There we go. Now I can hear you.
I don't know why that always happens, but anyway, aloha and good morning. Two things. The other day I was trying to explain to someone the American Constitution, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And in looking through it, Article 1 is all about the Congress, and they saved Article 2 for this person who is supposed to preside. And if he's a president, then he must be presiding. And if you think of any meeting where you might be the chairperson, as they call it these days, or even the chair, call on people to express their views at the meeting. And when you yourself, if you're the chairman, have a personal view, you have to temporarily hand the power of the chair over to someone else and then speak on for your own part. Am I correct?
You're correct. But you see, that's why the vice president is given the job of presiding over the Senate. And that's traditionally the vice president's job, and he sort of takes that over from the president, who presumably has more important things to go and do. But you're correct. Originally, and you need to remember, before George Washington, there were actually six other presidents of the Congress who held that job. But when George Washington became the president, he basically delegated the job of keeping watch on Congress to John Adams, who basically voiced a common sentiment that it's the most boring job in the world because he doesn't get to do anything unless there's a tie to be broken. But yes, under the Constitution, the president is technically president of the Congress, president of the Senate, but that job is delegated to the vice president, and sometimes it's even delegated to other individuals on a temporary basis.
Oh, I'm going to put in one for Sweden. The first president was from here. I think his name was Samuel Johnson or something like that.
Yes, that's correct.
That's all I can. That's all I can give you. I have a case of what we call Larry-itis here. I've got laryngitis, so I'm going to.
Don't kiss any pigs over there because that's still running. Put lots of cinnamon on your toast. Drink wine out of a silver goblet. Okay.
What about putting lipstick on the pig?
Well, I guess that'll make it okay. All right, we got to let you go, Thomas. Thanks an awful lot. Oh, there's an image I don't want to think about. Every time, lipstick on a pig. Oh, brings back bad memories of last year's election. All righty. I think the good news is, as long as we've touched on the topic of lipstick on a pig, it looks like Sarah Palin's ride in the eyes of the public is fading, and I don't think she's going to be a serious candidate for anything in the near future, as she was flashing the pan and she's gone. All right, we're going to take a break here. We'll be back for the last segment of hour number one of our show today. Again, if you want to join us on the air, 800-259-9231, and we will be right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
What this country is coming to, I sure would like to know. If they don't do something, by and by, the rich will live and the poor will die. Doggone. The panic is on.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show here. And we are going to be looking at a few other things. Getting an email here. Let's see if I can get back to us. Oh, yeah, confronting the government spooks. Somebody wrote in on the email and said they rationalize it with memes like, well, a person has to make a living, or a similar cliche so they can let themselves off the hook and continue their despicable behavior without guilt, and it is amazing. That's absolutely correct. A lot of people throughout history who have done these very horrible things, it proves time and again, humans have an incredible capacity to rationalize their behavior. And very often we do find it tied up with religion. You know, God wants us to do these things. You know, we will not get into heaven unless we go out and slay the infidel kind of mentality. People are capable of an incredible amount of gross self-deception when it comes to these things. And it is amazing. And the thing is, for the most part, unless you're a true sociopath, and we do seem to have a lot of those in our government, but unless you're a true sociopath, somewhere down the road, it does tend to come back on you, where people in the exuberance of youth and that fanatical fervor that the young are so capable of, the true believer mentality, where it's okay for us to break the law because we serve a higher purpose, a more noble goal for the betterment of the entire nation. And usually all they're doing is they're putting money in their own pocket. But as they get a little bit on in life and they look back and history begins to judge them harshly, you know, I wonder if they still can maintain that sense of fanatical certainty about the rightness of what they did without driving themselves crazy in the process. Which is not to say that I have any sympathy for them. I don't. You know, if they wind up in an asylum banging their head against a rubber wall, that's fine with me. I would be perfectly okay with that, you know. But it does unfortunately lose its deterrent value when you allow the tyrants and dictators of the world to have a comfortable retirement someplace else on the planet. And but we'll see. We're obviously at a crisis point in this country. And I'm still hopeful that the U.S. government is simply going to collapse of its own rot the way the USSR did, and that we'll transition to something a little bit better without a lot of violence. But there's no question in my mind we're heading for a crisis of some kind. And certainly the U.S. government is preparing for a violent confrontation with its own people. And as they say, time will solve that mystery. I do think that as we get towards the end of summer, I think we're going to it's really going to start coming apart. Part of what's going on right now is we're seeing the U.S. government attempting to puff up a lot of false confidence in the economy. And I've commented on this before, and over at Washington's blog, there was an article, it's also linked at whatreallyhappened.com, and it's titled, Why the Government's Attempt to Instill False Confidence Will Backfire. And it hits a lot of the same points we've been making here on the show, that the U.S. government and the financial establishment are not really doing anything that is consistent with the long-term recovery of the economy. They're basically looting the poor to give to the rich, and they're trying to make things look good and positive in the hopes that if they can just hold things together long enough, that we, the American people, will somehow come up with a way to save the economy for ourselves, that we'll find new products to sell, we'll invent new things, and we'll start making ourselves rich again, and then the government can come in and basically siphon off a little bit more. Which is kind of the way it's always done it. But in this case, and especially in the age of the blogs and the alternative media, this confidence building isn't going to work. And it's not going to work for two reasons. First of all, this idea that any economic crisis can be overcome by a good, strong dose of confidence presumes that there is no challenge to the illusion of confidence. And certainly that is no longer true in the age of the blogosphere and the alternative media. We are seeing every day the signs that the economy is not in good shape, that it is not improving. We're seeing more foreclosures, more job losses, and we're seeing the very obvious contradictions between what the government says it's going to do and what it actually does. Good example being Congress voting down the Foreclosure Relief Act without even a ripple of commentary or regret coming from the White House or from the TV networks, for that matter. And yet we're seeing more, you know, bailouts for the banks and bailout for this and bailout for that, all on the taxpayers' tab. Now, the other reason has to do with psychology, and this is also a topic we covered last week, I think. And basically, that the economy is not going to recover until the American workers see with their own eyes that the government and corporate criminals who created this mess and brought our country down are held accountable. There will be no real trust in the government until the people who ordered war crimes and torture and lied us into wars are punished for it, thrown in jail, some cases executed. The U.S. law on torture is very simple. If somebody is tortured to death, it counts as a first-degree murder and carries a death penalty. Until the financial establishment, the banks, clean their own house, and we see all the people who helped wreck the economy held accountable for it, nobody will trust the financial system. Nobody will trust the financial system at all. And people are beginning to rebel against the enforced involvement of the banks in all of their financial transactions. People are going back to keeping as much cash as they can and doing all of their business by cash transactions. They don't want the banks to get a piece of the action anymore. They don't trust the banks anymore. Why would you? The banks created this mess and then tried to blame the subprime mortgage borrowers for it. And now that we're seeing prime mortgages fall and these people start to lose their homes, it becomes very obvious that scapegoating the subprime mortgage borrowers, that's all it was. It was a dodge to protect the truly guilty. So just putting a happy face on this situation isn't going to fix things, because we, the American people, we're just discouraged, we're disheartened. You can't expect us to be enthusiastic about going back to work hard for very long hours, for very little money, and have the government basically siphon it off to make rich people richer still, and to pay for wars that we all know are started on lies and being fought for the benefit of a foreign nation. It is unrealistic for the government to expect that they can convince and persuade the American people to go back to their oars or their millstone or their plowshares with any kind of enthusiasm at all. In fact, if anything, I think our current situation, we the American people are as afflicted with a terrible malaise as the people of the former Soviet Union, and for pretty much the same reason. In the former Soviet Union, it didn't matter how hard you worked. You had the same lifestyle. Unless you were politically connected, then you got the goodies. But unless you were part of that political ruling elite, throughout the Soviet Union, it didn't matter how hard or you worked or how lazy you were. You got the same paycheck. And inevitably, people just gave up trying to be enthusiastic about what they were doing. And that is one of the reasons why the Soviet Union came apart. The same thing is happening here. Think back to the end of World War I and the so-called Bohemians or the lost generation who'd been through this horrible experience and spent their lives convinced it didn't matter what they did or how hard they worked or what they built, because another war could come along at any time and destroy it. After World War II, the same thing happened again. We had the beatnik generation, people who just couldn't bring themselves to get enthusiastic about building anything for the future because of the awful reality that it could end at any time the next time somebody wanted to start a new war. And we're going to see the same thing happen in the United States out of the current situation. Because no matter what you do and how hard you work, some government program is going to take it from you to give to the bankers. Or they're going to spend it on all these wars being fought around the world for reasons that nobody seems to have a grip on, other than it's what Israel wanted us to do. So all this false confidence stuff, it isn't going to work, and yet that's all they seem to be doing out there in Washington, D.C. All right, we're going to take a break here for some commercials and news. We'll be back in about 7-8 minutes with more news, your phone calls, and until then, aloha, America.
The the Michael Rivero What Really Happened radio program.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to hour number two of our insanity here today. And we're going to go right to the phones. We've got Steve from Israel. Shalom, Steve. Welcome to the show.
Good afternoon or good morning, whatever your time situation is, whatever time zone you're in out there, Michael. You'd mentioned something right before you went to break, and it's something I've been trying to get out to the mass public for a good long while now. Very much like the king in the 1700s backing off to save face in the international community, he backed off militarily from wiping out the colonists in order to save face, and infiltrated the American system through the central banking system in 1913. A very similar situation is going on today with the United States and Israel. That is that Israel will lose face in the international community if they outright attack their long-term enemies. Therefore, very much like the banks in 1913, the United States military is now fighting Israel's enemies and fighting Israel's wars by proxy. My question is, what more can we do to get this information to the public? To expose the fraud, the absolute outright raping of multiple countries by an out of control military force. Maybe out of control might be an incorrect term because they are in perfect control, but in the control of the hands of those who would have this country brought to its knees.
Well, I don't know how much in control the military is right now, considering the thrashing about in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I think further wars are very ill-advised for purely logistical reasons here. And, I mean, without getting into the politics, without getting into the morality, I don't think we can actually win any more wars. I don't even know that we can win the ones that we're stuck with right now. But as far as what's going on, I think more and more people are very much aware of what's going on between Israel's proxy wars and using the U.S. to do their dirty work. Unfortunately, one of the biggest problems that we do face here in the United States are the so-called Christian Zionists. And the really fanatical end-time Christians, including, I think, Sarah Palin's church, is part of this group, the Dominionists, who are absolutely convinced that if we help Israel start World War III, that Jesus is going to come down and invite everybody up to the big house after it's all over. And these are people who so want to get into that heaven that they will set fire to the entire world and their neighbors' children to do it. And that is a very, very tough political force to overcome right now. And apparently all these constant exposures about pedophilic priests are not having a significant impact because, well, you know what they say about blind faith. It is blind. They're so caught up with these illusions and hallucinations in their own head, they're completely disconnected from the real world. And it is very, very dangerous to have people like this with their fingers on the buttons for the missiles and the nuclear bombs.
I agree.
And it is amazing that we have seen throughout history that, you know, more wars have been started with religion as the excuse than any other cause. And while the perpetrators of the war, the ringleaders themselves, may not be particularly religious, they do find it incredibly useful to convince people to go invade another country and steal their wealth and bring it back in his infinite mercy without having to pay these mercenaries what it's really worth to do that kind of job. So it is an issue. All we can do is keep talking and keep sharing. And, you know, at some point, as they keep embarrassing themselves with all of these lies and deceptions and torture, you know, the fact that Christians support the use of torture, I think that's something that has to come back on them. Sooner or later, they've got to look in the mirror and say,
that's
is that
insane.
Really what it means to be a Christian to sanction torturing innocent people to death? I don't think Jesus would have approved of that.
No, that's anti-Christian. In my opinion, that is anti-Christian behavior.
Now, well, I would
against all the teachings of this supposed Christ. Anyway, that's all I got, Michael. Thank you for your time, sir.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you very much for the call, Stephen. You're absolutely correct. This is not what is taught in the New Testament. The Old Testament is very different. The Old Testament is definitely about go forth and smite and hit these people and take their land and slaughter their cattle and short sheet their bunk beds and all the rest of that other stuff. But in the New Testament, you know, I sometimes think the story of Jesus is really drawn from two individuals who are merged, because there's the one who's the real obvious pacifist, who wants to remove the toll gate to heaven and say you don't need to go into church. You don't need to pay the priests. It is okay for you to talk directly to God, and this is how you do it. And then there's the other guy who says, I don't come to bring peace but the sword. You know, go forth and buy yourself a sword, sell your last clothes, and walk around naked, but have a sword in your hand. There's that other individual in there. And ultimately, you know, he was definitely a revolutionary on a couple of different levels. And he really did think he had a chance to become king of Judea because he was of the house of David and his wife was of the house of Benjamin, which gave him two dynastic claims to the rulership of Judea. And that's the reason the Romans crucified him and put that King of the Jews sign over his head, because he tried to lead a revolution. It's not like it was a unique event. There were revolutions throughout that whole period. There was one only another 30 years later, which is when my ancestors got kicked out of Judea and split for Spain. So anyway, but yeah, in terms of what the Christians profess to believe in about thou shalt not kill and God of mercy and love thy neighbor, for them to line up behind torturing innocent people to death, it is. It's a strange dichotomy, and it may be one of those situations where once they're tempted over that line, they can't look in the mirror anymore, and so they become psychologically trapped. And this is where fanatics come from, you know, where they're convinced they're doing God's will, but they really can't look at what it is they're doing and reconcile it with the teachings of their faith. And, you know, this is what the popes did when they started the Crusades and said, God wants us to liberate the Holy Lands from the people who have lived there the whole time. You know, which is, again, that's what Israel is doing now to the Palestinians. The Palestinians are the descendants of the biblical Israelites. And present-day Israel comes down out of Khazaria and says, oh, no, the Bible says this is our land, and hack and slash and white phosphorus. And it is absurd. And, you know, somebody the other day, we were talking religion, and they said, you know, what do you think about the theory of evolution? And I said, it's long overdue. It's about time we humans actually started evolving. Because I'm not seeing a huge difference between us and, you know, the apes in the jungle clubbing each other over the head. It is rather sad and tragic. Okay, getting back to the news here, I'm looking through the chat room and looking at people. They're talking about the financial situation. Somebody's saying, max out your cards, tell them to take a hike when they try and collect. No, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't do that. I think by and large, and I want to put this out here right now, I think by and large, the vast majority of Americans would love to pay their bills. They have a sense of honor, not found in CEOs and in our government, but they have a sense of honor where they would be perfectly happy to pay their credit cards and their mortgages and their taxes if they had the jobs with which to pay them. And the bottom line is our economy is in the situation it's in because for the last 30 years and especially over the last 8, government policy was to allow American companies to send the manufacturing jobs overseas. GM just announced they're going to do it again. After all the taxpayer bailout money they have taken, their plan for restructuring and bankruptcy involves offshoring even more of the manufacturing of their cars. They're using taxpayer money to move their operations to other countries. So long, Americans, and thanks for all the loot. We're out of here, is what we're getting. And so I'm going to repeat something that I said to Patricia when Patricia called in on the radio some time ago. And for those of you who've lost your homes, and I keep getting emails about people losing their homes, and you've lost your businesses and your jobs, don't be angry with yourselves. Don't be depressed. Be angry with the government. Be angry with the corporations. They did this. You did not do anything to deserve where you are. It was done to you. You did not create your poverty. It was created for you. We are not a capitalist society anymore. We are a fascist economy, which is the hallmark is profits are kept private to make rich people richer, and losses are socialized to make poor people poorer. We'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
The GCN Radio Network.
providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN, great talk radio starts here.
Some are maxed out all their credit cards. Some are working two jobs and living in cars. Minimum wage won't pay for a roof, won't pay for a drink. If you gotta have proof, just try it yourself, Mr. CEO. See how far 5:15 an hour will go. Take a part-time job at one of your stores. I bet you can't make it here anymore.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show. We were talking about General Motors' betrayal of the American worker by taking all these billions and billions of taxpayer dollars in bailout money, and as part of their restructuring reorganization, they are sending more of their car manufacturing to other countries. They're sending the jobs to other countries. And apparently, the U.S. government doesn't seem to have a problem with this, because the goal is to return GM and its stockholders, who we presume includes U.S. Congress critters, to profitability. And that seems to be all that they really care about at this point, is just more money, more money, more money, more money. And, hey, those American taxpayers aren't complaining yet, so we can just keep on doing the way things have been going. And I was watching in the chat room during the break, people talking about GM and saying that they don't buy GM products anymore. And unfortunately, that's another part of the problem here with the American auto companies. It isn't just the economy that slowed things down. American car companies just aren't able to produce the quality product that we're seeing from other countries. And it really began back, I think, at the time when gas prices really began to rise, and we had these huge American behemoth cars, and it was kind of amazing. I live in Hawaii, where we're all a little crowded for space, and parking lots are striped really narrow, and it's really tight. And the other day, I was over by the University of Hawaii, and I saw this old 1950s Cadillac, and it was painted candy apple red with the big fins on the back. And for those of you not old enough to remember these things, it is amazing. And it's huge. It is a huge, huge car. And it looked like somebody had just planted this boat in the middle of traffic, and everybody was having to, like, scrunch over to make room for it. And I have no idea where this guy parks it. It's obviously his pride and joy. And I presume he has a parking space or a garage at home where he keeps it. But wherever else he can park it, I don't know, because it really... It's definitely going to be hard to find a place to put that thing. And that was what cars were like back in the 50s, when gas was very, very inexpensive. Everybody wanted a big American car, and they were large and roomy and had lots of stuff. And then the gas crunch hit, and American cars stayed large because American car manufacturers got complacent. They figured everybody loves our cars. Nobody's going to want to change anything. They'd succeeded in driving the Tucker Torpedo out of business, which is kind of an American way of business, is to crush your competition rather than to compete with them. And meanwhile, over in other countries like Japan, they were coming on with a whole new way to make cars, and they started producing initially very inexpensive cars, and then as protectionist tariffs rose to make those cars just as expensive as the American ones to Americans, the Japanese and German automakers started producing better quality cars, figuring there's no real way to tariff that out of the equation. And all of a sudden, we had cars coming in from these foreign companies that were actually better made than our own locally produced vehicles. And, you know, I like to buy American, and I'd like to be able to honestly encourage you to buy American, but I can't, because every time I buy American, I get disappointed. I bought the last TV I bought, it's one of these ones with a glass tube in it. I don't have one of those big flat panel TV sets yet, but I do have a glass tube RCA set that the day we brought it home from Circuit City keeps having this green spot show up when it's in high def mode over on the left-hand side, and we're constantly having to degauss it. There's been a hum in its own internal speakers ever since we got it. I also bought this RCA VCR, the last VCR I owned before I went totally to DVD, was No, I'm sorry, I misspoke. The first DVD player I bought was made by RCA. And I realize it's not even made in the country anymore. It's designed in the United States, and then they find the cheapest overseas manufacturer to put it together so they can maximize their profits. And this RCA product, the menuing, the internal menuing, was broken, and it would continually lock up. And the same thing is true for cars. The last American-made car I had was a Chevrolet, and it was falling apart. And meanwhile, I have had incredibly good luck with every Japanese car I've ever owned. My last car was Honda Accord, and we had it for 14 years without any major problems. 14 years. And we finally had to trade up and get a somewhat larger vehicle because my wife's Harp wouldn't fit in the old Honda. We have a Nissan now. Same thing. It just runs forever without any problems. Doesn't have a lot of bells and whistles. Doesn't have this very sexy female voice nagging me to lock my seatbelt buckles or warn me that the doors are ajar. It's very simple, very basic transportation, but it is reliable with the capital R. And I remember the last very nice luxury car I had was when I was married to my first wife. And she and my money are now living somewhere in Texas, I think. And we had a Nissan Maxima at the time, which, for a car made in Japan, spoke very excellent English. That was a wonderful vehicle as well. I've had a Buick. That didn't work out very well. I've had a Ford van. That thing, the engine exploded on fire on me. So I'm sorry, guys. You know, it's hard to be enthusiastic about American automakers. And so I agree with the people in the chat room. Even if we save them, who's going to buy their cars? They can't make a product that competes with these other cars coming in from these other countries who know how to manufacture. It's a skill we've lost. We have this corporate political culture that thinks manufacturing is beneath their dignity. And we've had it ever since the end of World War II when the Harvard Business School came out with scientific management and the MBA. And the MBA produced a corporate culture with no respect for the products being made. And that attitude has now promoted itself to the corporate boardrooms. And instead of making products to make money with, our country has made money the product. We're trying to be a banking empire, and it doesn't work. Because you can't have 300 million people acting as bank tellers. It doesn't work out that way. The foundation of any economy is the productivity of the workers. Whether they're automakers, farmers, bricklayers, house builders, that is the foundation and bedrock of a national economy. And when you take them out of the equation, when you take their jobs away and send them overseas, the economy is going to collapse. You can't hold the economy up by the top. That's the thinking they have in Wall Street in Washington, D.C., because that is what works for them right now. But it won't sustain. It absolutely will not sustain. All right, changing subjects entirely. Apparently, one of the first major expeditions to the Arctic has come back this week. This was a 20-member expedition from Canada, U.S., Germany, and Italy, and they spent 1 month exploring the North Pole and found that the new ice is more than twice as thick as predicted by the global warming cultists. So Booga Booga, Al Gore and company. I guess instead of a carbon tax, they're going to ask for an ice tax now. We'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio? Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Aloha, America. Welcome back to the show here. We're going to jump around a few other stories here. I'm looking in the chat room and the email. A lot of interesting stuff being sent in about, first of all, this study of the ice in the Arctic, where they basically found that the new ice formations are twice as thick as the climate modelers and the global warming cultists were screaming. And, of course, right now here in the United States, we're all concerned with the economy. We're concerned with our kids being killed in these wars fought in Iraq, Afghanistan, soon to be Pakistan, soon to be Iran, and anywhere else where Israel just doesn't like those people. And we're much more concerned with that than this idea that if we don't do what Al Gore tells us, the Earth's temperature may raise itself 4 degrees in the next 100 years. It just doesn't seem to be that important. Certainly not as we go into what appears to be a very prolonged cooling period, where even here in May, there are still snowstorms in some parts of the Northern Hemisphere. So it's rather amazing here. Now, meanwhile, turning over to Russia. Russia is beginning to very discreetly rattle their sabers. And during May Day festivities, the Russian President Dmitry Medvedev issued a stern warning to any countries considering what he calls military adventures. Now, a lot of people could say that this is a very obvious warning to Georgia, which is starting to conduct its own military exercises again. And we know that the U.S. strategy for an eventual attack on Iran involves blockading Russia's ability to support Iran on the ground by tearing up Pakistan and by creating a border war between Georgia and Russia, which would close those mountain passes through the Caucasus Mountains. So we know that since November of 2007, the U.S. and Israel have been providing weapons and training to the Georgian troops. Didn't work that well, I might add, but it looks like they're still trying to kick up a little kerfuffle there, which would block those tunnels. And then if the U.S. can kick up a similar mess in Pakistan, then Russia would have to try and support Iran by air, which would be very difficult. The U.S. and Israel would have air superiority, and it would severely limit Russia's ability to logistically support Iran. So I think that's what's going on. So Russia's warning may not be just against Georgia. Russia could very much be issuing that same warning to the U.S. and to Israel, that if Israel goes in and bombs Iran's power station in order to try and ignite a war, that Russia will be forced to intervene on behalf of her ally. Now, I'm going to tell you right now, for all the talk and bluster, Israel is not going to bomb Iran's power station. And the reason is very simple. They don't care about the power station. What they want is a war between the United States, your kids die in it, you pay for it, and Iran, to smash Iran up the way Iraq was destroyed. If Israel bombs Iran's power station, then it's all over. There's no more nuclear threat from Iran, not that there ever was one. And everybody's going to say, okay, well, then there's no need to invade, is there? Because Iran doesn't have a nuclear reactor anymore. It doesn't have a power station. So Iran's talk about acting unilaterally to bomb the nuclear sites is just bluff and bluster, because if they go ahead and bomb the sites, the reason for a follow-up invasion is gone. And for that reason, I think all this renewed talk about Iran's nuclear threat, Iran's nuclear threat, Iran's nuclear threat, besides the usual warmongering, is that if Israel cannot get the U.S. and Iran into a war just by asking for it, that we may very well be looking at the PR run-up to another potential false flag situation. So take that for what it's worth. I think the more we make these possibilities public, the less likely it is to happen. And I'm perfectly willing to risk looking foolish by saying there might be another false flag, and then there's never one, and the usual shills will come back and say, you were an idiot, you were crying wolf, and the rest of it. So, yeah, okay, but, you know, I think the more that people realize it's a possibility, the less likely it is to happen, because the people sitting in those bunkers and saying, let's drop a nuclear bomb on Poughkeepsie and blame Iran for it, and then somebody else will say, well, you know, they aren't buying 9/11 anymore, and the people are very suspicious and skeptical. They could very well easily conclude that one of the supposed good guys is behind the attack in order to start a war. I mean, more and more Americans know that it was not a surprise attack here at Pearl Harbor, that Franklin Roosevelt not only knew about it, he goaded the Japanese into it. More and more Americans are well aware there were no torpedoes in the Gulf of Tonkin attacking the USS Maddox. that started the Vietnam War. More and more Americans are now aware there was no Spanish mine in Havana Harbor that sunk the USS Maine. It was blown up by an onboard fire that touched off a magazine. And even the captain of the USS Maine went on record saying, no, this is not an act of war. This was stupidity. It was a bad ship design. So Americans are coming to understand that most wars are initiated by fraud. We know how Hitler used his own people to attack the radio station at Gliwice, Germany, to blame on the Poles to justify that invasion. And most Americans are no longer supportive of the theory that Osama bin Laden, who, by the way, is ex-CIA, or was ex-CIA, he's dead now, and his family are still getting all these huge government contracts. Doesn't sound like he's a very credible enemy, a credible threat. The bin Laden family is still building a lot of our overseas military bases right now. So Americans and the rest of the world are very skeptical of these, and because of that, I hope cooler heads will prevail and there won't actually be a false flag attack. But, you know, it's very obvious. There are certain fanatical people who are just absolutely convinced they got to have a war. They got to have a war because the invisible man who lives in the clouds and talks only to them says they got to have it, or they make huge amounts of money off of war, trading the blood of your children for gold in their pockets, like Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld. And those people who think that if there's a new world war, that Americans will forget all about the economy and all about the war crimes and all about the lies and all about the assassinations and will line up behind the flag and salute smartly and say, yes, send us off to die by the millions fighting the evil, dastardly enemies. I don't think it's going to happen. It's a very different world right now because of, again, alternative media in the blogosphere. The dynamics of information flow through society have changed irrevocably. We're not going to go back to the world as it was at the height of the Cold War. No matter how much the corporate media and the government would like to see it happen, it won't. They have about as much chance of ending the free and open internet as the church had of shutting down Gutenberg's movable type printing press. They tried, didn't happen. They're going to try with the internet. That's not going to happen. It is a whole new world, and those governments and institutions that understand that and are able to evolve to meet that new reality, they will survive and they will prosper. And those that do not adapt to the new environment are doomed to extinction. I am convinced the U.S. government is one of those. It's only a matter of time. It is a walking corpse looking for a place to fall down, go boom. Meanwhile, turning over to Great Britain and aloha, Ben. I hope you're still listening to the show here right now. Apparently, the British government is now bringing in the armed forces to take over running some of the state schools. The official reason given is that the military will be put in charge of schools that have discipline problems, where the students are acting rowdy and the teachers can't get them under control, so they're going to bring in the military to run those schools. This is a pilot program, and obviously if it produces the desired result, whatever that desired result really is, the program will be expanded, and eventually all schools in the United Kingdom, owned by the state, may in fact be quasi-military academies. So we're going to take a break here. We'll be back for the last segment of our show today, 800-259-9231, 800-259-9231. Call in for the last segment. We will be right back.
Can we talk?
Can we talk?
Can we talk about gun control?
Gun control?
Seems like it should work, doesn't it?
It should work.
You'd think so. Yeah.
Pass the right laws.
Pass the right laws.
And you can disarm the criminals.
You disarm them.
That's the idea.
But the problem is...
The problem?
Criminals don't obey the law.
They don't obey the law.
That's true.
After all, they're criminals.
They're criminals.
Criminals. They'll always find a way to get guns.
No matter how many laws you pass.
Which means
they still have guns.
They still have guns. While the rest of us...
The rest of us?
The rest of us are just left defenseless.
This
is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome to the Michael Rivero What Really Happened radio program.
And aloha.
Call Mike now at 800-259-9231. 800-259-9231.
I keep doing that. I'm sorry, Mr. Announcer Guy. All right, so we're back here with the last segment of our show, and we've already got a caller on the line. We've got Mike in Texas. Aloha, Mike. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind today?
Hi, Mike. Got a couple of things. One is just your last little segment. You talked about the false flags, examples on back to the 1800s and whatnot. And I was just, here's just a contemporary story for this morning. I put on my World Trade Center 7 t-shirt today and went shopping. And just wanted to see what the reactions were, and it brings out shock, but it also brings out expressions of truth.
Mm-hmm.
And you just have to react to folks in a loving smile and a kind of a nod of the head, because it is about standing up for what is really happening and standing up against tyranny. And sometimes, it's a shock. People, they know something's happening. I know you've commented on that quite a bit, but there's just a fear of busting loose for free expression. And so, there's just a little anecdotal story in my own walk today. And then, I did want to challenge you a little bit on Buying American. I know in your last segment you talked about still are unconvinced about the American auto industry. And I would just say that lately, and there is only one way to turn it around, and that is to buy American and to bring manufacturing back to America. And that's what you said at the end of that commentary. And so we've got to go the distance on this and not contradict ourselves. And I would just say, in terms of buying American automobiles, let's look at the warranties that they're offering now. I mean, if there is some glitches or something out there, and I just don't think they exist as they did, a decade ago or so. But I think we do have some, backstop there in terms of the warranties that they're offering. And there's only one way to bring back manufacturing to America, and that is to buy America. And, so I just wanted to put that thought in your mind. I'm with you on 99%, but I was a little bit, disheartened, about buying foreign automobiles. I've heard that with some other talk show hosts, too. And so I'm buying an American automobile, and I say go America.
Okay, well, let me clarify the situation there, because the point I was making was not to not buy American, but I was trying to make the point that it's not enough to simply subsidize industries to just create make-do-work jobs, like the so-called shovel-ready projects and everything that Obama's putting out there, which really aren't going to improve our economy. They'll fill in the holes in the roads, maybe. But if we're going to bring back manufacturing to the United States, we have to also not just have manufacturing, we've got to bring back the quality as well, to make products that other countries are going to want to buy from us, from what are admittedly going to be higher prices because of the tax burden we're carrying in this country. So,
our standard of living, Mike, We have to quit this idea of we're willing to work for third, world wages and expect to have a first world standard of living. And I think that our founder said tariffs are the way, protectionism is the way. And that, of course, has been downtrodden by the current globalists that run our country. And so I think we have to live an American standard and protect an American standard.
Okay, well, I like the American standard of living, and I've done I don't know what happened there with Mike there. We have a high standard of living, and I think we can keep it without having to make it so expensive, because I've traveled the world, I've been to a lot of other countries, and I've discovered that the standard of living in these other countries is really not only the same as the American standard of living, in a lot of countries it's a lot better, a lot higher. The infrastructure is a lot more solid, the roads are better, the buildings are better kept up, it's cleaner. You know, our standard of living here in the United States is not all that different from most other countries. The difference here is that in those other countries, when you're paying XYZ dollars in taxes, you get stuff back for it, like medical care and free education. Here in the United States, most of our tax money is going to this gigantic war machine that spends all of its time figuring out how to justify its continued existence by dreaming up enemies in some other part of the world and coming up with a reason to send them in there. We could cut federal taxes by 50% across the board if we could just lose this psychotic need to go around the world killing brown people. And then we could have the same standard of living, but we could charge considerably less for the products made in this country, and that would make us competitive on the world marketplace without sacrificing our standard of living, at least at the working middle classes. Yes, we have some ultra-rich people who have extraordinarily palatial standards of living, and maybe it's not unrealistic for them to sort of come back in line with the rest of the world, because if you look at CEO compensation packages in the United States, they are hideously out of step with the rest of the world. With CEOs in Japan, for example, or CEOs in Europe, they're paid more than their coworkers, but not these incredible, you know, $1 billion a year compensation packages that we see in some of these hedge fund managers. And we need to get back to that here in the United States. We need to join the modern world is what we need to do. We're still living in the 50s and 60s. We're still living in the age of fascist economies. We need to join the 21st century on a lot of levels. I think American manufacturing can be the best in the world again. It's going to take a lot of work to do that. And what we need to do is we've lost our ability to compete on personal electronics and automobiles. And I think we could spend a century trying to play catch up and not get there, because these other countries are not going to give up the leads they've built in the last 30 years. So what we really need to do is we need to invest in the next technological revolution on which a whole new category of products is going to be built. And then when we're the only country that knows how to make those products and we're making them, then the money starts coming back in. And what that development could be ultra-cheap desalinization, could be photonics as opposed to electronics. That's the coming thing. There's some demonstrator technology about that already. Definitely some new energy systems. Apparently, even the U.S. military is finally admitting there is something to the cold fusion process. We need to let go of propping up the old industries and old infrastructure and say, okay, it's time to let these companies that have gone out of business, let them go. And we need to take that same money. Do you realize with $12.8 trillion, which is the government's commitment to prop up the existing financial structure of the United States, if we had put that money into pure research, there wouldn't be an energy crisis anymore, and therefore no reason to be invading all these countries across the world. I mean, with $12.8 trillion put into primary research and building up of new industries and factories, we would be the rulers of the planet again. Instead, we're throwing good money after bad to prop up the banks and the brokerages and companies that have already demonstrated they can't make a competitive product. Okay? It's like taking $12.8 trillion and using it to bolster the candle maker and oil lamp manufacturers because they're being unfairly victimized by the new electric light that Edison just came out with. The world is evolving, the world is changing, and what we're seeing from our corporate and political leadership is they don't want to change. They don't want to give up how things were at the height of the Cold War. They want to try and drag us back to that Cold War, permanent war preparation mentality. We can't afford that anymore. The rest of the world isn't doing it. The rest of the world is living in the 21st century, and so should we. And that means we have to really go back and reexamine some of our primary attitudes about how we feel about manufacturing. We need to regain our enthusiasm about making really good things. We're starting to see it. There's some really cool TV shows on how it's made, which is a European import, but it's re-enthusiasing people about actually making things and how it gets done and how these products get made. And we're starting to see more and more of these kind of shows that say, okay, you don't have to be a CEO to feel good about yourself. If you're building a really good car, you should feel good about that. It's more than most CEOs can do, certainly in the age of the MBA. And, you know, we need to go back to this idea that the management of a company should be people who grew up with that company and who know it from the inside out, instead of some hired hotshot from an Eastern university with a degree who has no clue at all about what's actually being made on the factory floor. We need to get away from that idea as well. That's it for our show today. We'll be back Monday at 5 p.m. Central Time here on the Genesis Communication Network. Until Monday, please take a moment to go out on Twitter, on Facebook and MySpace, and talk about our show a little bit. Draw people in here. Draw them into the website, whatreallyhappened.com. Help talk us up. Help spread the word and get an audience. Call your local radio stations and demand that that nutcase, Michael Rivero, be added to the lineup of your local station affiliate. So, until Monday, stay safe, be well. Have a good weekend. It's gorgeous weather here. I hope it is where you are as well. And aloha, America.